I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Happy Friday and happy Groundhog's Day to everyone. And welcome to Minute 60 of Season 6 of Movie on Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to finish off this week is Duncan Shields of Chronologically Speaking. Welcome back to the show, Duncan.
Greetings, programs. Hello, how are you? I'm glad to be back here.
And I'm glad to have you back on this Groundhog Day. So minute 60 begins with George beginning to think that maybe he's not a muggle, and ends with George questioning his orders. So basically, this minute opens up with a line, we're a couple of financial wizards. So if you're a wizard, that means you're no longer a muggle.
Yes.
That's what it comes down to. And then we get Uncle Billy says, yep, call us Rockefellers. So, I mean, these are really interesting ways to refer to themselves, you know, this whole thing. You know, like just to say we're financial wizards, Tolkien's the Lord of the Rings had already come out at this point, hadn't it, in the 40s? I'm trying to remember. I thought it came out in the 30s. Am I right? Or would it come out later?
I remember Christopher Lee saying that he was, I think, late teens, early 20s when he was really enjoying the books. But he was like, you know, I read the first one and I knew it would be 2 years before the second book came out. And that was a long 2 years for me to wait for book two of The Lord of the Rings to come out. And then I loved that one so much, so I knew it was going to be 2 years before book three came out. And it was interesting to hear him talk about it in that way, like you're waiting for the next Harry Potter book, like you're waiting for the next, you know, Game of Thrones book. Like he's like, we were all born when they're a finite entity in the past, but he was like chomping at the bit to read the next book when it came out. So that strikes me as a 30s kind of situation.
Okay, so the Hobbit came out in 1937 and Lord of the Rings only came out in 1949.
Oh, 49? Wow, I didn't realize it was that late. Okay.
The Fellowship came out in July of 54. The Two Towers came out in November 54, and The Return of the King came out in October 55. So within a period of a year and a half, all three of them came out, basically six months apart. 6 months between the first and second, and then almost a year between the second and third. Wow. Well, at least he wrote it all beforehand. You know, it's not like, what we have with Game of Thrones, where...
Yes.
So...
Yeah, I've given up. I doubt it's going to happen, but... hope springs eternal. Maybe we'll see.
Maybe. But even thinking about it from that perspective, so you know the term wizard, these scenes are taking place in 1932, 1933, so they don't have the Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit to think about with that. So it's interesting that the word wizard was common. It was a common term that was used at the time. Even if they're talking about financial wizards, they're still talking about wizards.
Well, it's that W, right? Like, witch, wise, wizened, wizard, weird. You know, they all come from that same clutch of words. You know, that WYRD. You know, like the wizard and the witch and the weird, and that's all fey folk. You know, really old world language. That's like, it's probably from the Celtic or something like that. There's probably some deep etymology origin to the word wizard.
Okay, makes sense. But it's just a little strange to think of it from. I mean, obviously, he's not only referring to it from a fantasy perspective, you know, because he's saying financial wizards. You know, so the the definition of a wizard isn't necessarily going to be something from a fantasy perspective.
Yeah, just a magic user. It can be this cake is amazing. You're like a cake wizard. You know, like I think that's something that probably goes back into the 20s or, you know, the 1800s, 1700s. You know, like I think wizard is, I don't know if it is present in a Shakespeare play, but I would not be surprised if it was.
Right. I mean, based on what I looked up, it, you know, basically the term of a wizard is, the definition is a man who has magical powers, especially in legends and fairy tales. And then you have computer related stuff, which obviously was not, it was not what George Bailey must be referring to, because it's a software package that automates complex tasks, you know, by asking questions and stuff like that. So it's basically someone who's skilled in magic or magical power. So basically, you know, by calling someone a financial wizard, you know, is that someone who has special financial powers?
Well, looking up the etymology here, it's from Middle English.
The word wizard.
No, wise.
Not wise. Okay.
Yeah, the word wizard is, but so it just means like a philosopher or a sage, and it's directly from wise. It's like a descriptive word when you know something is, you know, I don't know. Oh my God, why is my brain? It's an adjective, like a wise person is a wizard. You know, like that person's really wizard, you know, like that person's really jacked, that person's really, you know, tall or whatever, that person's really wizard. You mean like they are a person of wisdom, they are a wise person. So that eventually just became wizard. So, you know, anybody, and, you know, generally speaking, you know, the wisest among us are in the later stages of life, and so they have experience to draw on. So I imagine in a patriarchal society, we're looking at old men with long beards.
Right.
So that's eventually the stereotype that became a person who was a counselor to a king or a sage or a philosopher or somebody who was writing down words that were worth pondering on. And eventually it became synonymous with magic user.
Right. Okay. True. Do you know any?
Curious to know when that took place.
Can you think of any famous person whose nickname was the Wizard?
Well, it was the Wizard of Oz, and then there's Pinball Wizard.
I'm talking about a real person.
A real person. Oh, a real person. I don't know. I don't know. Nothing. No one's coming to mind immediately, but I'm sure if I really sat down, I could probably think of somebody. Do you have a few examples?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. So you have the Wizard of Menlo Park. Do you know who that is?
No.
Thomas Edison.
Oh.
He was known as the Wizard of Menlo Park.
That makes sense.
The baseball player, the Hall of Famer, Ozzie Smith, was known as the Wizard.
Oh, no way. A baseball player known as a wizard. I love it.
Well, because he was known as the Wizard of Oz.
Ah, okay.
And then, going along with your, the fact that because you're Canadian, maybe you know this if you're a hockey fan. There's a former hockey player named Ray Whitney who was known as the Wizard. You familiar with him?
No, I don't really follow hockey that much.
Oh, okay.
I'm a bad Canadian in that way.
Okay, fine. He played for the Carolina Hurricanes. Where he won the Stanley Cup with them in 2006.
Wow!
And he was a stick brother with Wayne Gretzky. Interesting.
What does that mean? I don't know. I'm not familiar with the term stick brother.
Sorry, stick boy. Stick boy.
Stick
I
boy.
think that means they're the guys who held, like a bat boy type of thing. You know, the guy who's holding the.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
So like
I think that's what they meant.
a younger
I misunderstood. I
a
thought at first.
child a child assistant.
Yeah, I was thinking at first that it's someone who, you know, that he played with Gretzky, but no. So no, not really. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of other people. Warren Buffett is known as the Wizard of Omaha.
Oh, okay.
Then you have who else? There's no one else here really that sticks out. You have a no, it's a basketball player named John Wooden, who's known as the Wizard of Westwood. I don't know. No, so that those are the big ones that I found. And then he mentions
Yeah.
the Rockefellers. Are you familiar with the Rockefeller family?
Indeed, indeed, indeed. They're I think they were they bankers or something? I know
They
they're
were
at this point they're basically famous for being rich, but
yes,
I think they're I'm not really sure of
they were
their.
bankers. They were much into the industry, and they have one of the world's largest fortunes. They made their fortune in the petroleum industry in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. There were two brothers named John D. Rockefeller and William A. Rockefeller that had a company known as Standard Oil,
Right.
which was later broken up into Exxon and Chevron.
I
And
see.
they have a long association and control of Chase Manhattan Bank.
Ah.
They are known as one of the most powerful families in American history, and
Yep.
their family originated in Germany in the Rhineland, and they moved to the Americas in the early 18th century. So,
Now, who was, I know there's a family that was famous for literally inventing banks. They would lend money to kings to win wars and then ask for repayment with interest. And I thought it was either the Rockefellers or, well, I don't know, whatever. I don't remember.
are you talking about the Rothschilds?
That's the one.
There you go. Rothschilds.
Rothschilds.
Okay. All right. It's close. It's an RO.
I think that's why I get Rothschilds and Rockefellers mixed up sometimes, is because that's actually they actually have a similarity in the name there.
Yeah, they were in Germany, and then they there was actually a movie about the Rothschilds. Back in the 30s, it was nominated for Best Picture. I'm trying to remember what it was called, but it was basically about these five banking brothers in different countries, and lending money to each of the kings, based on what you were saying, but helping them finance
Okay,
the.
right.
In 1934, the movie was called The House of Rothschild.
House of Rothschild, there you go.
Yes, I actually enjoyed that movie. I'm probably should rewatch it one of these days. I haven't seen it in a few years. It was a great movie that shows the power that bankers can have when dealing with kings and stuff like that.
Well, it's like in Game of Thrones, right? The Iron Bank.
Right.
Right, there's the Iron Bank. That's the shadow behind everything,
That's right.
right? One thing I really like about this movie was the road to its creation. How it didn't, I mean, I don't know how much you've talked about that, but it was a short story.
Yes.
Do you talk about
Yeah, of
that? It
course.
was
The
a short story
greatest
called
gift.
it was yeah, The Greatest Gift, and it couldn't get published, and so the author printed off 200 copies and put it in his Christmas cards.
That's right.
And just gave it out. And then that got into the hands of an RKO executive who gave it to Frank Capra, and they wrote the script and stuff like that. And one thing I found that was interesting about some early drafts of the script was that there was no Potter. It ended up being a good George and an evil George.
Right.
It was a George who was meaner and had made worse choices or something like that. And they ended up having a fight on the bridge, and the good George kills the evil George.
Ooh.
And that was one of the first drafts before I think Capra and a few other screenwriters decided to add the Potter character. And I kind of want to go across to that other world and see see how the Good George, Bad George film did. But when this film came out, it didn't do well because it was too much of a downer,
right,
for a Christmas movie. So it kind of came and went, and it wasn't until the 70s when there was a slip up on the rights.
That's
and
right.
It went into the public domain. And so that's why it started being played every Christmas over and over again, because it was free. But I also think there was something that happened with 70s audiences finally being ready for this movie.
Right.
Because it is a downer. It's a huge downer. I'm always amazed when I watch the movie how long it takes for George to end up on the bridge. Because the sort of famous part of the movie is him experiencing life in Pottersville if he had never existed.
And it's only like 5 minutes of the movie.
It's just a little 5 minute chunk at the end. And I'm always like, oh, I always thought that was like the movie.
Right.
But it's not. The movie itself is this complete downward spiral, this wearing down of this stand-up guy until he breaks. When he's abusing his kids and he's just like at the end of his rope, it's hard to watch because you know he's been such a good guy. You know, like it weighs a person down to stay true to their dreams.
Yeah.
And when their dreams go unrealized, you know, like I think it was in Braveheart when they said, "Uncompromising men are easy to admire." You know, that's a line that really, really, really stuck with me. But there's this temptation. There's this belief that if you sell out, then your dreams can be realized.
Right.
And even if you're doing it at the cost of your principles, yeah, it feels like you'll finally be able to relax and enjoy the life.
Correct.
But, you know, trick, you know, oops, just kidding. There's no relaxing and enjoying life. Not really, ever. Like here and there, maybe, but not for long. You know, whether you've stuck to your path or you compromise or you sell out, the struggle will always be there.
Right.
And it's your character and your word that are all you really have. And no matter what people say, that's the real currency of the world. But life is hard, and I think that's why this movie resonates.
Mm-hmm.
I remember...
You got to work at it.
It's sort of... It's similar in a way to The Shawshank Redemption, in that this movie speaks to people on a really personal level. Like at the turn of the century, Empire magazine in the UK did a poll to say, okay, what were the greatest films of the 20th century? Everybody write down your answers and send them in. And on the December 31st issue or whatever, we'll publish the top 50 movies of the 20th century. And number one was Star Wars trilogy. And I think number two was the Godfather trilogy. They just put them all together because they were like, okay, we can't list them separately. But then number three was The Shawshank Redemption.
Interesting.
And everybody was kind of like, what? You know, and there was this moment, I think, that everybody had, because it wasn't on a ballot. You wrote down your answer and you sent it in. Like this is collated from people just writing down their favorites. And so there's this moment with Shawshank where you're like, well, I knew it was my favorite movie because it really speaks to me. But I didn't realize anybody else felt the same way, you know, because you have such a personal connection with that movie. And it's similar with this one, how, you know, the trials that George goes through in this film are so, it's almost voyeuristic watching, you know, the veneer of his ability to deal with life get stripped away over the course of, you know, an hour and 15 minutes before he jumps off a bridge or wants to jump off a bridge. You know, and it's this moment of we've all been there, you know, to one extent or another. You know, we've all been there. And I think that's why this movie is so enduring and why it'll keep on being something that everybody, you know, wants to see. But even Frank Capra said that it was made kind of by accident. He said, not kind of by accident, but he said, this is a quote of his. He says, there's more to the picture than I put in it. There's more to the picture than was written in it. There's more values in the picture than we knew we were playing with and that we didn't expect. And that's probably the answer to it, that there's more to it than we thought we had. And I think about that a lot, because there's a lot of movies out there that were made that accidentally capture something way more than the sum of its parts, you know. And you know, like Shawshank, like, I don't know, Donnie Darko, like Ghostbusters, like Blade Runner, you know, like there's these films that were well made and well crafted.
Mm-hmm.
Or pick up on South Street's another one. Right? Like, you talk about the behind the scenes people, and it's like, why did you use that iconic pier set? And it's like, oh, well, it was still set up from a film that had been shot 2 months previous. So it was supposed to be in a dingy bar, but we thought that looks pretty cool, so we used that one. And then it was like, you know, how did you find the actress that played the love interest? It's like, well, she won a beauty contest in Ohio 2 months before we started filming, and she had come out to LA, so we used her. And you know, like, you know, or like they asked one of the lead guys, you know, what did you feel when you were making this movie? Could you see that it was, he was like, I made 11 movies that year, you know, and that was movie 6. And I was on movie 12 when movie 6 hit the theaters. So I could sort of remember filming it a little bit, but I'm really glad it did well, you know, like, so there's this when you're churning out 200 movies a year, you know, one of them is bound to just, you know, slot machine style, end up becoming something amazing. But there's a lot of movies out there that sort of, there's an alchemical reaction where they become more than the sum of their parts. And this movie's definitely a great example of one of those movies. Like, everybody performs well, but the script you're writing is not the movie that people saw.
Right.
You know, you wrote a movie about a guy going through some stuff, and it has a happy ending. But the movie that people saw was a very resonant, personal tale that became a part of their soul. You know, so it's a different, it's more than what they intended.
Right. It's true.
And
I completely agree with you.
It was great to hear Frank Capra. It's great to hear Frank Capra say that, because there's so many directors out there that will take 100% of the credit for whatever happened and say, I meant to do that. But it was amazing to hear Frank Capra say, oh no, this was way more than we intended.
Right.
And I'm like, good for you, man. Good for you. So I think that's a real, that's why I want to check out more Capra films now.
There you go. Now you have a good reason to do that.
Pretty stand up guy.
Yeah. So then we continue with George, and he goes, get a tray for these two great, big, important simoleons here. Have you ever heard the word simoleon before?
I have. I've heard it a lot. Greenbacks, simoleons, dollars, moolah, dosh, cash. Like, but I'm never really sure where the word simoleons comes from. It sounds like it would, like, Mesopotamian or something like that. But
it comes from in the late 19th century, the word simon, which means dollar.
What?
Yeah.
Simon means dollar?
Mm-hmm. Huh. It was British slang.
Simon. Gosh, I didn't know that at all.
So basically, that's what they're talking about here. You know, it's U.S. slang for a dollar.
Well, all right.
And then he goes, we'll save them for a seed, a toast to Mama Dollar and to Papa Dollar. You know, he's raising up his little glass of possibly whiskey at the point there. You know, and if you want to keep this old building and loan in business, you better have a family real quick. And then we get the response, I wish they were rabbits.
Yeah.
I wish they were too. And they said, okay, let's put them in the safe and see what happens. And they start singing and dancing as they take these $2 bills into the, you know, into a secluded area where they can reproduce like rabbits. You know?
Yeah. You know, yeah, I think a lot about this scene in George, about how he's a leader who doesn't know he's a leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, he doesn't understand that he's a weather vane, that he's a bellwether creature, that everybody follows his lead. He just thinks he's, you know, struggling his way through life and trying to do his best, and he doesn't realize that he does actually have a parade of people looking to him for the direction to go in, to follow him. And, you know, I think about that a lot. When you try to ask a leader how to be a good leader, they're like, I don't know. You know, they're like, what are you talking about? You know, they're like, I just lead. You know, you tell people what to do and they do it. Why are you asking me how? You know, like, you know, they can't see the forest for the trees because it's who they are. They're just, that's just what they do. They're just effective. Or they'll say, I'm not a leader. No, are you kidding? These are just a bunch of people with similar interests that we're all going down the same path together, because they're ignorant of the fact that they're actually the person in charge. You know, so, and that's the kind of person that George strikes me as, is he has no idea the impact he has on this town.
No question about that at all. And then they put the you know, the tray with the $2 in the vault, close the door. And then he goes, folks, wedding cigars. Oh, wedding. Apparently everyone's forgotten the fact that they, you know.
Even the guy that's got married has forgotten about this.
That's right.
Oh my God.
And then he goes, holy mackerel, I'm married. So holy mackerel is basically a cleaned up version of Holy Moses or Holy Mary.
Ah, you know. Okay.
And he goes,
I was wondering, because I know it's there's in the Catholic religion, there's a fish on Fridays kind of a thing, right?
You're asking the wrong person about that. I definitely don't know.
I'm asking the wrong guy, yeah, for sure. But I think there's a thing about, like, you don't have meat on Fridays, so you have fish. So that's part of the reason why they created a Filet-O-Fish at McDonald's, was because they wanted to break into that market. There was unexplored potential happening on Fridays in you know, small towns that were like mostly Catholic. Is there was no business at the burger stores on Fridays. Mm-hmm. So they tried to, what can we pitch on Fridays, and as a fish on Fridays thing. So right. I can sort of see, like, or the loaves and fishes, there's a holiness attached to fish in some regards that I'm dimly aware of. So that's where I figured holy mackerel.
It's very possible that there is some sort of connection to that. And then George goes, where's Mary? Yeah. Mary, poor, look, I got a train to catch. Well, the train's gone. He looks at his watch. I wonder if Ernie's still here with the taxi cab. And then Tilly goes, George, there's a call for you. He goes, look, will you get my wife on the phone? She's probably over at her mother's. Mrs. Bailey is on the phone. I don't want Mrs. Bailey. I want my wife. Mrs. Bailey. Oh, that's my wife. Here, I'll take it in here. Mary, hello. Listen, dear.
Classic.
I'm sorry, huh? Come home. What home? You know, I love the whole fact that he gets confused about who's Mrs. Bailey, who's his wife, what's going on. I mean, he's obviously had a very stressful day trying to deal with the whole thing.
I love his I love this moment of him playing catch up with his own reality. he's been deep in the zone, you know, deep in the zone with what they call it, the flow state or whatever. He's been in this other world.
Mm-hmm.
That's taken up 200% of his attention for so long, and he's successfully saved the bank, you know. So yeah, he's like, oh yeah, I got married today. That's a great clip when he's like, I don't want Mrs. Bailey, I want my wife.
That's right.
Oh right, Mrs. Bailey. That's such a good
well, it's good that he's able to figure that out real quickly, that Mrs. Bailey is his wife. You know, that's already it's already a good stage. It's good point that he can figure that out. All right, great. So I mean, there isn't that much to talk to in this minute, so you know, we actually, I don't have anything else to talk about in a minute. Do you?
I got, I just a few comments about how this is a wonderful capture of an entire life, where, you know, it starts when he's young and goes to when he's, you know, pivotal moments. And it's sort of a painting of his whole life, but there's like an older movie in the 30s called The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp.
Yes, I've seen that.
Which was a great, I thought that was a wonderful way of, oh, it's really hard. It's one of the problems I have with biopics, is they pick, like, they cherry pick one or two moments and make the whole movie about those one or two moments. And it's really rare to see a movie that accurately portrays a person's entire arc of their life. There's like The World According to Garp, I think, is another one that did that. And this is one of them. So it's I think that's a real a real, you know, a real triumph. And it just also that everybody remembers that the every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings, and Zuzu's petals, and all this stuff. Like, everybody remembers the happy ending, which to me is very unrealistic. And it almost like he did jump off the bridge, and this is his death hallucination, is the happy ending. Like, but the heart of the film is darker. It's a dark-hearted film. It's like kind of like Christmas Carol. It gets it gets really real. But it's kind of one of the reasons why I think I avoided it for such a long time is because whenever anybody talks about it, they talk about, the kid at the end, the sick child. It's one step away from, you know, God bless us, everyone. Like the ending of it is so saccharine and smarmy and Christmassy that I'm like, I don't care. But then when you really sit down and watch it, you're like, this is a realistic and a dark movie. It's like I think it was Muhammad Ali who said, a man who thinks the same at 50 as he did at 20 has wasted 30 years of his life. And there's people who say, like, you know, there are movies and books that you read that are the same book, but they're different depending on when you read them during the course of your life.
Correct.
And I think this is one of those movies that when you see it when you're 15, you're like, oh, okay. Hey, it's a Christmas movie. But when you see it when you're 65 or you're whatever, you're like, this movie really packs a punch. This movie is a very important and emotional ride. And this is definitely one of those films, I think. I also just want to mention that Mary's horrifying fate made me laugh. just that her horrifying fate is that she became a librarian who wears glasses.
Yes.
Oh no. You know, the entire town is filled with like gambling dens and neon signs and, you know, juke joints and like nobody, everybody's a horrible, horrifying, broken person. And then she wears glasses and is a librarian. And to include that outcome in the same fate as everybody else, I thought was hilarious. Like, oh no, she's an old maid. You know, she's probably got three cats. The horror. I'm like, oh, well, you know, tap the brakes a little. Her life hasn't turned out that bad.
Right, exactly. Yeah. No, yeah, I agree with you on that.
But that's, yeah.
But, what's your background with this movie? We've talked about it all week, and I never asked that question. Like, when do you remember first seeing this?
You know, it's entirely possible that me purposely sitting down and watching it beginning to end, I might have done that for the first time in preparation for this podcast.
Oh, wow.
I may have seen it while my parents were watching it when I was a kid and I was in and out of the room. I've often seen it imitated. I may have caught it in passing on TV shows in some, some Christmas seasons when I've had nothing else to do or whatever. And I've seen so many clips of it referenced by so many other shows over the years that I feel like I've seen it 7 or 8 times, but I honestly can't pin down a memory of watching it beginning to end. So
interesting. Okay, well, I'm glad that I was able to force you to do so.
Yes, I'm glad too. It was fantastic to go into the origins of this movie. I had no idea about the origins of this movie. That blew my mind. That it had kind of a bizarre Plinko-esque fate, you know, like to wind up becoming a cultural touchstone of a civilization every Christmas. It very nearly wasn't. So that's it's fascinating to me. And I just love it. Yeah. Such an amazing performance. And the moral is so good. And yeah, it makes me want to watch a whole bunch more Capra films. So I'm happy
it happened. There you go. Too. All right. I'm glad I was able to affect you that way too.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay. So every Friday we have a segment called Oscar Oops. And the idea behind this segment is that over the last 95 years of Oscar movies, so every year there's always arguments as to what movie really should have won or whether the movie that won was deserving or not. So, you know, I thought it would be interesting to hear from my guests what they think are in their mind the 5 biggest Oscar mistakes over all of these years, you know, which movie do they think should have won that didn't win? And obviously, the only caveat is a small one, that it has to be something that was actually nominated. You know, you can't say that in 1982 Tron should have won because, you know, it was a great movie, but since Tron in 1982 was not nominated, you can't do that
But
in this scenario.
the way it was not nominated is so egregious. But yeah, they said that computers were cheating, so they don't count as special effects. So
There you go.
it was disbarred. It was excommunicated. It was forbidden from even competing. And I'm like, oh. Breaks my heart. It stabs me right in the neck every time I hear that. I'm like, oh, to be on the cutting edge of something and then to just be eschewed by your peers. Oh, horrible what they did. Horrible what they did. So in 1998, I think Life is Beautiful should have won over Shakespeare in Love. I enjoyed both films, but I think Life is Beautiful was a much more quote unquote important film. Than Shakespeare in Love. And now with the Weinstein, you know, stuff like that, there's this, it's kind of, you know, it feels bad that Shakespeare in Love won when you're like, what kind of backroom deals went on to make that happen? Every time a
That's right.
Weinstein production won at the Oscars, which happened a tremendously high number of times, because he did have the power to make that happen. But I'm sure compromises were reached in order for the Oscar statue to change hands. Anyway, in 2010, I think I personally, these are all personal choices. This is
Yeah, of course.
not, you know, empirical things that I think they got wrong. I just think if I was in charge in 2010, I think Black Swan should have won over The King's Speech. But Black Swan's a very, very intense, dark film, so I guessed that that's not very Oscar. 2011, I would have taken Moneyball over The Artist. I would have taken almost any of the other movies over The Artist. The Artist was well made, but there's this, Hollywood is in a love affair with itself, and you know, you make a movie about the glory of the 30s film industry, and then Oscars are just like, oh, amazing, give it all the awards. And that's, I think, why everybody was shocked by, was it Babylon that came out 2 years ago or last year?
Last year, Babylon,
Yeah,
yeah.
everybody was surprised that Babylon bombed. And I was like, I wasn't. I'm like, nobody cares. 1930s Hollywood, stop.
Yeah, I hated that
We
movie.
get it. You know, we get it. You know, I don't want to see a bunch of rich starlets getting involved with fame and drugs and, you know, whatever. We get it. It was a time of opulence and excess in Hollywood. 2018, I think The Favorite should have beaten Green Book. I didn't mind Green Book, but I really think The Favorite should have gotten the best picture for that one. And for 2015, this is going to cause a little bit of controversy, but I think Fury Road should have beaten Spotlight. But that's just me. I know Spotlight is a perfect Oscar movie, and it is an important film, not a quote-unquote important film, but an actually important film. But in terms of filmmaking, in terms of creating a movie, I think Fury Road is amazing and was streets ahead. Like, for me, Spotlight is the script and the performances, and for Fury Road is the performances, but also, yeah, the art of putting together a movie, I think, was accomplished much, much better with Fury Road than it was in Spotlight. But I understand the subject matter of Spotlight. You know, give it all the awards so that everybody goes to see it. It's an important movie that tackles an important subject, which makes it pretty much guaranteed win for Oscar season. But for my money, Fury Road should have won. That would have been incredible. I would have loved to have seen the day when an action movie took home Best Picture because it was just so well made.
Okay, you are not the first person to put that up there on your list. So,
Oh, fantastic. I'm so glad to hear it. Good, good, good.
yeah. All right. So, Duncan, for one last time, do you want to tell people where they can find Duncan Shields?
Go to Chronologically Speaking or go to By Duncan Shields on all the social medias. And I forgot to mention, I did write a book of short science fiction stories called Small Windows. which is available on you know, Prime and Amazon and all the places where you normally get your ebooks. So check that out if you like a little short science fiction story extravaganza.
All right, very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook. So, Duncan, thank you very much for joining me this week. I've had a great time. I hope you have too.
I have. As we're heading into the final sign-off, I did want to say that my brother and I had an inside joke of, I wish I had $1 million. Hot dog! Like, for our entire lives, just because... it's a non sequitur. Watching that as a child, we're like, I have no idea what he's doing there. I have no idea what he's lighting. I have no idea why he would say hot dog. I don't know why he would make a wish on this lighter. You know, like, nothing about that moment made sense to us. So it just cracked us up every time. So, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't been able to figure that out yet. You know, why, where's the special... you know, idea of being able to, you know, make a wish on it. I think it's just the idea of you make a wish on anything, you know.
Is it faulty? So it only goes off a fifth of the time? So that's why,
no.
That's why the
no,
wishes? Or the, like, is it a, you know, who knows?
Not that I could figure out.
Right, yeah. And so is it a lighter? Is it for lighting cigarettes?
It's a cigar lighter.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah, it's a cigar lighter. All right. So I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.